Well, good day, everybody, and welcome back to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's great to have everybody checking out the show again this week here at disasterpodcast.com or maybe wherever you happen to be grabbing the show. And wouldn't be a Disaster Podcast episode if it wasn't for my good friend joining me, my co-host and esteemed partner in this endeavor, Miss Sam Bradley. How are you?
Hey, Jamie. I so love being esteemed. I have to look that word up. It's kind of gloomy here today. It actually was a really bright, sunny weekend, and now it's all kind of gloomy and cool again. And is it still winter in Maryland?
Believe it or not, the weather has actually turned. It's been up in the mid-50s this week, since Sunday, I guess. And we're just happy to have some decent weather. It's a little rainy today, but we'll take it. Most of the foot or so of snow we had on the ground is completely gone. So it looks like maybe things have finally turned.
Spring has sprung. And Dr. Joe, we got you on the line. How are things in Memphis? You were having a terrible time down there with ice and snow and whatnot.
Well, hello, guys. Yeah, we've had a bit of the winter weather ourselves. It's been raining for the last 48 hours here now, but temps are back up in the 50s, and most of the ice and snow we had from the prior weekend is melting away if it's not gone already. So
we're getting
ourselves. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this part of the country doesn't do well with that sort of stuff.
Yeah, you guys are used to warmer weather. Well, what else is in the news, Jamie? I haven't had been on the news much.
We were talking before we started recording, and Joe alerted me to a news item that he had seen. And thanks for bringing this up, Joe. But just released from the U.S. Geological Service is the chance of a major earthquake in California higher than thought based on recent research. They're expanding their expectation to a 7% chance of having a magnitude 8 or larger earthquake sometime in the next 30 years. Now, you know, Sam, you've heard that before, I'm sure.
Well, the 30 years has been around for a while, but not that I think it was a lower percentage of chance that could happen. So that's bumped it up some.
Well, and I think the 30-year thing is a regular thing. They renew periodically every 5 or 6 years. It's a 30-year outlook, and based upon their current data that they have in, they see seismic activity. And basically what they say is that the tectonic forces are continually tightening the springs of the San Andreas Fault System. Yeah. And a big quake is inevitable.
Ooh. Well, as much as I love my friends in Southern California, I hope it's down there. No offense, guys. Yeah, really. Well, maybe by then I'll be retired and be in Colorado. So, you know.
Well, let's hope so. Well, yeah. I can certainly tell you that you know, earthquake is very high on the concern meter for FEMA in their planning scenarios. I'm actually headed to Florida tomorrow for a FEMA USAR training, annual training session down there. And pretty much every time we've looked at, you know, big scenario stuff, it's all been focused around earthquakes, either on the New Madrid or on the West Coast. So it's a big concern for FEMA.
Well, good. Maybe you can give us some feedback on that when you get back. And speaking of training, good segue, Joe. So is this just a meeting or is it actually a training? Are you just talking about the training you should be doing?
This is a 2-day continuing education session for the incident support teams that are kind of the command and control pieces of the federal urban search and rescue system.
Excellent. Yeah, there's going to be some good stuff that comes out of that. And I'm sure there will be more discussion of this prediction.
Absolutely.
Not only that, but then we get to hear what you learned in a future episode, which is great for everybody checking this out.
I'll come back and report on it next week. So it should be great stuff. I'm looking forward to it.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, and maybe this is a good time to segue into our topic for tonight. We're going to be talking about training, and some of the things that we're going to focus on are some interviews Sam did at EMS Today with some people, a couple of people that actually experienced the Paragon cadaver lab at EMS today that Joe and Jim and the rest of the team at Paragon Medical Education Group put on. And I think that we're not, while we love to focus on what you guys do, Joe, I really want to focus as well on how students take away things they learn and then apply them directly in the field.
Well, that sounds great. That's exactly why we do it. And I'm eager to hear these too. I've actually not heard these interviews that Sam's done. So I'm looking forward to hearing what it has to say. I hope it's good.
Oh, it is. It is. And I really enjoy talking to these people because I get a bit of a different perspective from all of them. We did it the very first year that you did the experience, and I'm getting a whole different feeling and a different flavor from them now. The first guy was a young medic, and I don't remember exactly where from, but he went to the first experience when he was, I believe, just learning to be a medic. He was in his internship, and this poor guy could not drop a tube to save his life. He was really stressed over it, and this, I think, is one of the key factors that he mentioned in here, is this was a low stress environment. So whatever it was, he learned, and he said the difference was doing this on a mannequin versus doing this on a human, basically. And something he learned in his technique, or maybe it was something that inspired his level of confidence, whatever it was, he walked away feeling really good about it. And he said, this was, I don't know, however many years ago since you did the first one, I have not been successful with a tube ever since. And I remember bringing up something about the King tube, and he said, oh, don't worry about those because I never miss one. So that was pretty amazing. So it's showing that even though you guys do a lot with basic skills, just the fact they're not doing it on a plastic mannequin is giving them a whole different perspective and a whole different feel for how things are done. What's your thoughts on that?
I think you touched on the two probably key points to, to furthering your abilities in that lab. And that is the second one first, which is confidence, knowing that you've actually done that on what was real living tissue with the variabilities that are associated with that, and the landmarks, the feel, the nuances that are part of all of that. The second is that, because we don't rely exclusively on plastic heads or simulators, et cetera, you learn to appreciate that what really takes a average or mediocre medic into the stratosphere as far as being a phenomenal medic are the subtleties of how we do what we do. And it's a really fascinating process in the lab to watch folks go from that kind of brute force, big grip on the, on the laryngoscope handle, to pulling and pushing and twisting and tweaking and all that sort of stuff that they're used to doing on a simulator head, because the plastic, that's just what they're used to doing. So they get used to, I've got to pull really hard and crank this thing way back and all that sort of stuff in order to get this thing done. And to watch them as they evolve and appreciate that, wow, if I just ease back on this a little bit, and if I just lift this way and do these very subtle things, which almost nobody would even recognize unless you were paying attention to them, that intubation becomes much easier and much more natural. And just as the person you were talking about related, your failure rate goes way down. I mean, we fail because we're learning on plastic heads, which is not what we're doing in the field. And I certainly appreciate that, in the field under real circumstances, you don't have an opportunity to go slow and appreciate those subtleties. You're in a life and death situation. You got to push forward right now and just do the best you can do. But the ability to do that in a non-stress, non-rushed environment is phenomenally important. And, I think it's hard to appreciate how much difference it really makes until you've experienced it for yourself and suddenly realize that, you know, intubation is not nearly as, you know, a brute strength skill as you thought it was. In reality, in most cases, you can hold the laryngoscope with two fingers and get the tube right in every time and, you know, get a few of those techniques and tricks that allow you to speed that process along and make it work pretty quickly. So it's just part of the fun part of education. You know, you don't know how much you don't know until you know it.
Well, let's go ahead and listen to that one and we'll let the folks hear what he had to say directly.
What's your name?
I'm Joseph Horst. I'm from Berks County, Pennsylvania, and I work for Southern Berks EMS as a paramedic.
So what made you decide to take advantage of the experience here?
Well, I've done it last year.
Oh.
And it was probably the best thing I had. I had very trouble with my intubations prior to that. Came down here, learned a lot. Haven't missed since, and I'm back here to keep
awesome.
On top of it.
Oh, they're going to love hearing that. I hope you tell Dr. Joe that.
I love this. It teaches me so much, and I get to just practice without being under any pressure, and it's just a great learning time for me.
But you find it an advantage to actually use cadavers instead of plastic mannequins?
Oh, yeah. There's no comparison to a cadaver to compare to a mannequin. Cadaver actually is like,
awesome.
I go down here and practice, and it's like real life.
So are you using equipment that you don't ordinarily use in the field?
We have the King Airway, the King Scope, and, you know, a lot of rescue airways. But as far as some of the regular intubation equipment here, it's a little bit better here.
And you, because I've used the King, I think it's pretty interesting, but there's a different technique involved.
Oh yeah, very different.
So you have to kind of learn that technique. So your intubations have been spot on ever since you got to practice here.
Yeah, and I haven't had to use the King.
Oh, look at you. All right. How long have you been in EMS?
I've been in EMS for 5 years, been a paramedic for 3.
Well, good for you. So what else do you like? What's another one of your favorite things?
The IO practice is excellent. I mean, you don't do a lot of it, and especially practicing with the humerus. It's not something that is quite as easily caught on as it is in the legs, and it's just great practice. Come up here and just go over it. And anatomy is a great just refresher to go over it, and I always learn something new every time I'm here.
So you find it even a low-stress kind of environment to work in.
Yeah, if you mess up, big deal. You get to go back in, relearn it, and practice till you get it right.
And you got a pro right there to help you if you've got
exactly
an issue
right.
with technique or
These
whatever.
Guys know what they're talking about.
Wow, that is awesome. I'm so glad to hear that. So you'll be back again?
Oh, I'm sure I will be.
Thanks so much.
Hey, not a problem. Thank you.
Bye.
So I'm glad we had a chance to review that because a couple other things came up in my mind. And when you're talking about skills or somebody that's really having a trouble with a skill, this is such a small group. I don't think I've seen more than maybe 6 people in any given group that you work with, and then they rotate around from one thing to the other. But if somebody is having a little trouble, you have mentors there. You have other folks that can watch what they're doing and maybe help them over that particular hump that they seem to be having. So I think that's important. And Joe, you mentioned something earlier, and I'm not sure we were even recording then, but about skills retention and the fact that, and especially up here in Northern California and some of the bigger cities, there's so many medics that doing the infrequent skills may come along once in a blue moon. And when they do come along, everybody feels real stressed out about them, and the likelihood of failure is higher. So this is a really good place to stay on top of that, don't you think?
Well, I agree with you completely, Sam. You know, that's certainly an issue that EMS medical directors face everywhere in the country. You know, we have new techniques, things like CPAP and that sort of stuff that have reduced the need for intubation on many patients, which is great for the patient and great for the system, but ultimately leads to, you know, fewer opportunities for those high-risk, low-frequency skills. And ultimately, where that sort of leads to is everybody gets to do a few less of those, and if you don't practice those skills, you tend to get rusty on them. So I think for an awful lot of medics in the field, there's a real challenge there to keep yourself highly proficient in those incredibly important skills, but the challenge is I don't get a chance to do them very often. And when I do get to do them, they may well be on a, you know, a mannequin head or whatever. And we probably don't take them quite as seriously in those situations as we should, because that may be our only opportunity to do an intubation for months to come. And that skill dilution is a very real phenomena and a very, very important one we're going to have to figure out a way to deal with in EMS in general, and disaster medicine even more so. Disaster medicine is even less frequent than sort of day-to-day EMS.
Well, and it's Joe. I mean, you guys are great that you bring these cadavers to these conferences where people can get hands-on experience with a real human body to feel what the tissue feels like and the real resistance factors associated with connective tissue and everything else that goes into it. But cadavers are expensive and they're hard to come by, and they aren't something that everybody, even if they go to conferences, is necessarily going to have an opportunity to have access to. So do we need better training tools? Are there other options besides having to just use a cadaver to do these, to do these skills?
Well, I certainly think that the simulation side of things continues to get better and better. I don't think it's a replacement. I think it's a good supplement and works well in conjunction with the human tissue stuff. You know, there's a lot of different options for cadaver labs. For example, we'll be doing a big cadaver lab down in Florida later in the spring, and that's actually a series of five different fire departments that are all joining together to split the cost and share the expense of bringing us in and doing a cadaver lab for all their entities. There's also opportunities for sponsorship and that sort of stuff from either healthcare entities like hospitals and others, or grant funding, or even sometimes industry sponsorship as an opportunity to give folks a chance to look at products and compare their products with others in a very real life environment. And, we work very hard to try to make the cost as reasonable as we can make it and still, cover the expenses that we need to cover. But to also, when we're working with a sponsor, we're very upfront with the sponsor and basically say, here's the deal. We're happy to show your product in the lab and let students work with it, but realize that your competition is going to be in there as well. And we're not going to favor one over the other. And if you don't think your product is as good as your competition's, then you probably shouldn't have it in the lab, because the people that are going to be making the decisions here are going to be the students who are going to walk out of here going, I used A and I used B and B was a whole lot better. And that's just going to be how it's going to be. So, I think it's helped us in a lot of ways in that the folks that, from a sponsorship standpoint, that we work with have been, have a lot of confidence in their products, have very good quality products, and, are comfortable allowing them to be compared head to head with other stuff on the market. And I think that really allows for a service who's trying to decide, do we want to go and buy brand A or brand B video laryngoscope, which is a pretty expensive item, to come into the lab and try both of them on real tissue and see the pros and see the cons, as opposed to doing that on the simulated mannequin that was built by the same company that makes the laryngoscope. So obviously it works every time on theirs, but it really gives you, I think, a much more level playing field to make decisions like that.
And I would think that would be a great benefit to the vendor. If there is something that isn't quite as good with it, then they need to know that. They need to know what maybe a little more research they need to do, or how can they tweak it to make it better than the other one. I think that's great opportunity for them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's the ultimate testing ground. We're very lucky in that we have access to cadavers that allow fairly extreme use of those cadavers, so we can put them in environments that are much more consistent with what we see out in the field, and we can show injuries, and we can perform procedures that are you know, pretty amazing compared to what many labs are able to do. And again, provide that really unique experience that I just don't think you can get anywhere else.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Jamie, let's cue up the second one because, we're going to take this whole idea just a step further. So let's listen to what Dina had to say, and then we'll talk a little about that.
So what's your name?
My name is Dina Weirich, and I'm here from Suffolk County, Long Island, New York. I work for Suffolk County Emergency Medical Services down there.
So what do you think about this experience?
I think this experience is great because it's different. It's a hands-on experience. I'm an educator by trade, and I know that my students always learn better by hands-on. So by coming to an experience like this where we get to actually put our hands on these patients, we get to feel, we get to do real-life training. And I think that you learn so much more by hands-on than you could out of any textbook or video or anything, really.
So you're thinking, like, learning intubation this way instead of through a mannequin is valuable?
Absolutely. Mannequins are wonderful necessity training devices for basic training, absolutely, but they're not realistic. They just don't move the way a human moves. They just don't have the same feel. So this is much more, it's important to learn technique on a mannequin, absolutely, but then for real life application, it's important to use the cadavers.
Well, it was interesting because the young man I just interviewed said, you know, he was a new medic when he came here the last time and how he was having trouble with intubations. But after he did the lab, he went home and he hasn't missed one since.
Correct.
So I guess it's a good way to perfect your technique, even if you're a long-time provider.
Absolutely. I've been a medic for quite a few years. I've actually come to the Advanced Airway Cadaver Lab every single year, every single conference. And every single time I come here, I learn something new.
Well, it's good to know you're a repeat offender.
Yes, I am.
And it's good to know because I noticed something that the first year they did this, that even Dr. Joe was doing basic airway. He's doing BVM. And people were fascinated with watching him, so they were learning something new. And who thought you could learn something new about a bag valve mask?
You know? Right. It seems like such a simple technique that you read about and you practice in a classroom. But then when you take it here and you put it in a real-life perspective and you actually see how real people move with the BVM, it's much, much, much more, it's a much more fulfilling learning experience.
So what's one of your favorite things you've learned here?
My favorite thing, I learned a new trick for the bougie, which I've been teaching bougie now for about 2.5-3 years. We just got it down in my service, and I actually learned a new trick today. I'm very excited. I have it burned in my memory. I can't wait to go home and show all my students. In the other airway station, I learned that I can fit into really tight, small tent-like spaces and intubate sideways. Who knew? And in the anatomy station, it's just so phenomenal to get your hands on things that you read about in books. For example, a pericardial sac, you read about it in a book how tough it is, but then when you put your hands on it, you pull on it, it really is tough. You know, you read about all these things in the book and the aorta and the ventricle, but then to see it and really get your hands on it, I think you absorb it more. I think you learn more from that, absolutely.
So you're saying that we as EMS providers really need that hands-on experience in order for things to really make sense. Mannequins aren't doing it. The book's not doing it.
Mannequins are great to teach you technique, but to really understand and get a whole full perspective, The patients are definitely the way to go.
So you'd encourage other educators to come and take advantage
Absolutely.
Of this.
Absolutely. I'm an educator, and I sign up for this course every single year. Yes.
And we kind of think we know everything after a while, don't we?
Not me. I'm here every year, and I'll be back next year. Definitely.
So here's kind of the other end of the spectrum. You know, the first one we talked to was a younger medic, a newer medic. Now, here's someone with years of experience, and this is not someone that off the top of your head you'd really think could gain as much from the lab like this. However, here's somebody who went crazy over learning something simple like a technique with the bougie, which you really think is a kind of a simple thing, although Jamie made a point earlier that not everybody uses it consistently, and I think that's part of what we're talking about here. But she got really excited about this thing that she learned even as an experienced medic. But taking this a step further, here's somebody who's an instructor. So she was really excited about the idea of then taking this piece of information she learned back to her students. And this is someone who has been at virtually every lab you've ever done. And I saw this as a theme, and unfortunately I didn't get a chance to talk to as many people as I wanted to, but I'm seeing this as a very strong theme. You don't see these people because you have them dressed up in gowns and masks, but trust me, there are a lot of the same faces under those masks, and this was pretty impressive, and she was so enthusiastic. I just loved talking to her.
Well, that, yeah, she was amazing in the lab as well. She was very, very excited. And, you know, I think that's one of the really unique things that we get to do there is because we are all over the country and we interact with EMS professionals from, you know, every part of the country all the time. Everybody has some unique and different perspective on things. And I think just, you know, it's such a breath of fresh air when even the folks that are the educators can appreciate, I don't know everything and I learned something new. And, you know, your mind is open to the fact that the stuff that we learned is always changing. It's medicine. It never stands still. And, you know, the tools that we have out there, while they're the same in many ways, they also continue to get improved in many ways and they change. And we it's imperative on everybody in EMS and disaster medicine as well to maintain that open-minded approach and the need to sort of continuously push forward with where's the science and the experience taking us from where we used to be. Look at things like hemorrhage control and what a difference you know, some military experience has made and some new products on the market are making in our ability to control life-threatening hemorrhage in patients. So it's a fascinating and exciting place to be. And I think for us, it's even more so because we sort of feel like we're right at the crossroads of that in so many ways and so many new technologies and ideas and approaches and concepts flow through our labs that, you know, we get very excited about it. And it's part of what we love about what we do is our ability to go out and show those to other people in other parts of the country.
Well, as a final thought here, and I know we got to wrap it up pretty soon, you had some of the folks from London Ambulance there and talk about a different perspective. Now, these people are learning a very different perspective from you, but didn't you pick up a few things from them as well?
Oh, I did. Yeah. So I am... was so pleased to have several guys from London Ambulance Service come through our lab this year at EMS Today, and they were amazing folks. And one of the things in our airway station that they did that was distinctly different and clearly very ingrained in their practice was a sort of a, I guess, a pit crew approach almost to their procedures, and that is that they were very choreographed in what each member of the team was going to do, and their communication between each other was amazing. So, for example, the medic whose primary responsibility was to use the laryngoscope and put the tube in would be saying to his other team members who were assisting him in some way by getting the tube ready on the bougie or suction or whatever else was going on that, you know, I've got the laryngoscope in place. I see the cords, hand me the tube. And then the other medic would say, here's the tube on the bougie ready to go, you know, and it was very choreographed. It was incredibly well managed. It was smooth. Everybody knew what was going on. And it reminded me very much of our, you know, current approaches toward things like cardiac arrest, where we're using that kind of pit crew approach where each member of the team has their assigned duties. And there's much more open communication between folks about what they're seeing and what they're doing and a much better situational awareness amongst the team. And I thought, man, there is so much for us to learn from that approach in how we do things and how we put our teams together and how the medic, especially a situation where the medic is teamed with, you know, for example, an EMT or an advanced EMT or someone with doesn't have his level of training, how incredibly important it is that communication flows all the time between those folks so that they know what each other's doing, they know what to expect, they know what's coming up. And I think we've all seen that in some partnerships, some teams that just seem to know each other's next move without speaking. But what those guys have done is sort of take that to yet another level where they can they can do that with every person that they're partnered with, because they're all thinking in the same terms and they're all verbalizing their actions and their visualizations and their where they're trying to go and what's coming next, so that it just flows smoothly. The next thing is ready to be handed. The next item is prepared, and it just makes the whole system work very smoothly. So it was a fascinating thing to watch and a very impressive thing to watch. Those guys were just amazing.
So even you learned something new from the experience.
Absolutely, I did, as I always did. There's always something new to learn.
So, Joe, as we wrap up here, what do you, when you have a student come into one of your experiential training scenarios, whether it's a cadaver lab, whether it's a full-blown drill with scenarios and things like that, what do you want the student to do to prepare? Is there something that somebody coming to use to one of your training sessions that they can do to be prepared so they get even more out of it? What do you say to people? Do you get in contact with them ahead of time?
Well, you know, we certainly try to let them know what they'll be doing and seeing in the lab. We like to obviously keep it a little bit in suspense, as it were, just because that's part of, especially when you're working toward a disaster related scenario, that's part of the training. Is I've got to deal with this right now. I didn't have time to prepare. I have to go with what I got. The procedural cadaver lab approach is a little bit different in that we can spend more time talking specifically about what we're going to be doing. But, you know, I think the most important thing that I see happen there is folks who are willing to ask questions about what's going on, and to appreciate that even the simplest tasks that we do every day or seem very simple and straightforward are not nearly so simple and straightforward. The first thing that comes to mind is application of a tourniquet. And, you know, we spent 45 minutes on how to put a tourniquet on, and the very, very subtle differences between putting it on this way versus that way, and how tight do you have to get it first, and how do you use that buckle like you're supposed to, and a realization that those things are a lot harder to do right than you think they are, and how much time, if you don't do it right from the beginning, that you actually spend trying to make it right in a situation where you've got very little time to stop life-threatening hemorrhage. And here you spent 3 minutes putting a tourniquet on, and then you got to take the whole thing off and tighten it all up and do this and change that to put it back on again. And it's sort of like, well, the guy's bled to death, you know, while you've been trying to take care of this tourniquet thing. So it's just a realization that even something as simple as that has so many layers underneath it that you don't ever appreciate until you really get a chance to do it slowly and look at the differences and sort of just think through the most simplistic aspects of it to appreciate, wow, there really is a way to do that quickly and easily with mechanical advantage working in my favor, and make that happen the first time right every time, so that I can take care of this patient and then move on to take care of another one without having to worry that that's not quite tight enough, or it's going to leak, or it's placed wrong, or whatever.
Well, not to mention all the different kinds of tourniquets there are out there now.
Absolutely. And they all, you know, my personal opinion is there's one kind of tourniquet that works really well in arms and another one that works really well on legs. And it's just simply inherent differences in how they're made and what you have to do to get them on. And, you know, but nobody carries two different brands. They all just carry one brand. So
food for
now
thought.
The question is, which brand are you carrying? Are you carrying the better for the leg or better for the arm brand?
And you better hope you get the right one.
Question for the week.
Yeah, that is. Well, hey, Joe, where can folks find you? Because, you know, we've been talking a lot about the experience they get from training and educating through using the tools you guys bring at Paragon. So where can they find you if they want to get in touch with you about bringing you into their system? And I love the idea of what you've got coming up in Florida, where, you know, people are talking, well, maybe your county or your jurisdiction can't afford to do some of these major evolutions, but maybe if you combine forces with a neighboring jurisdiction or two or three or four, you can pull together and bring something completely unique in to raise the educational level.
Well, you're exactly right, Jamie. There's a lot of different options here. And so I would certainly just encourage folks to reach out to us at ParagonMedicalGroup.com or on Facebook at Paragon Medical Group as well. Our Twitter feed is ParagonMedEDU, and you can obviously contact us through the Disaster Podcast as well. So we're happy to talk about all those different opportunities and options and ways to make this stuff happen.
Excellent. Sam, how about you? Where can we find you?
Well, in the usual social media places, Sam Bradley11, pretty much anywhere. Just tweet me or what's the word I'm trying to say? I'm blowing it again, Jamie.
That's all right. Well, they can leave a comment over on the site and that'll get a hold of you. And then we can all, there are all kinds of ways to get a hold of us. So Twitter,
there's all
Facebook,
kinds of ways
whatever.
To get a hold of me. Just Sam Bradley11. What I was trying to say is just if you search me, you're probably going to find that somewhere.
Yep.
And I, this whole topic of education is a good one. And I think, you know, we're talking more or less about static skills-based entertaining education. Now we've got the throwing everybody in the mix and really putting them in a situation that they may never have been in. And like you were saying earlier, Joe, just kind of really throw the stress level in there and say, okay, how are you going to deal with this? So I think that's another discussion we need to have down the road. But please please come up to the disasterpodcast.com where you'll certainly find me there or Dr. Joe or Jamie or any of the people that we've interviewed here. And please give us some ideas on what else you'd like to have us talk about. And we'd love the comments we've gotten so far and we'd love to have some more.
Yeah, definitely. And we do respond back to every single one of those comments. It might take us a day or two, but we will get back to you. When you leave a comment there, it actually emails me. So I know when the comments come in and then I can reach back out and address the comment to whoever you'd like me to address it to, whether it's Sam or Joe or one of our other guests. So get over there, get to disasterpodcast.com, leave a comment. Just say, hey, I liked the show this week. We'd love to hear from you. That's it for us. I guess we'll go ahead and wrap up. Sam, you know, we've talked a lot, and these two people that we brought on in the audio interviews this week from EMS Today have certainly affirmed what we've been talking about all the time about disaster medicine.
Absolutely. And I really hope we can do this again. I so enjoy the feedback we get from those people. And I hope that Paragon's out there doing a lot more of this because I think it's a great opportunity. And we haven't talked about it so much in the disaster setting, but it certainly would be perfectly appropriate for that, especially when we have this big earthquake coming to California. So it really shows that disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.